Thanks very much. It's nice to see you all. I'm very pleased that you're here in one of the very, very last sessions. I'm sure you're all exhausted. I know I would be if I'd been through what you've been through the last 3 days. But I am excited you're here. I am a historian. My name is John Weir. Currently finishing up a PhD. I'm also an instructor in history at a college called George Brown College in Toronto. My research is on the YMCA. So my thesis is currently... My thesis is basically a history of the YMCA's involvement in military work, so work with soldiers. This is going to be a little bit different. So this has sort of taken me in a new direction that I haven't done as much research on until quite recently, in order to sort of fit with some of the themes that you've been talking about. And so, of course, I'm going to be talking about environmental education, sustainability, and camp. My talk is called Rambling Tours to Overnight Camp, YMCA Camping, Outdoor Education, and Environmental Stewardship. When I talk about outdoor education in this title, and as I discuss this further, I'm going to make a distinction between outdoor education and environmental education that I think is really quite interesting and quite important. I didn't grow up in the YMCA. I'm very new, well, actually I'm not very new anymore to the YMCA, but I came to the YMCA later in life. I didn't do YMCA swimming lessons. I didn't go to a YMCA camp, either as a camper or as a counselor. And so that's not my background. My background with the YMCA comes from my wife, who worked for the YMCA for 14 years, and also from my own, you know, quite in-depth research on the YMCA for the last decade. But I do understand, I think, through this research and through this involvement, some of the things that YMCA people find very important. So I'm going to tell you a story. And it's a story, it's my YMCA story in a way, or it's a story of mine, a story from my life that I think links to the YMCA in a very interesting and important way that's going to illustrate what I'm going to be talking about here when it comes to the YMCA's history of overnight camping. My religious and cultural background is Mennonite. For anybody who doesn't know, Mennonites are sort of a smaller sect, Anabaptist sect, pacifists. There are groups of Mennonites who withdraw themselves very much from society. My family is not part of that group. We're General Conference Mennonites, and so those are very worldly, Protestant, you know, essentially Christians. I grew up in Winnipeg, which is very much a center of Mennonite culture, Mennonite society, Mennonite religion. My family are all Mennonite, and so I was very much a part of this growing up. And so my experience often of summer camp and of recreation was done through Mennonite organizations and Mennonite community groups. One of those groups, or one of those organizations, is an organization called Camps with Meaning. And of course, Camps with Meaning is a summer camp system. There are three camps, or there were three camps in Manitoba under the Camps with Meaning, Camp Moose Lake, Camp Koinonia, and Camp Assiniboia. Only Camp Assiniboia is left. The other two have since closed. But I very much grew up in the world of Camps with Meaning. These are some pictures, a mix of institutional pictures and a mix of personal pictures. My grandfather, I live seniors over there, Henry H. Gertson, died in 1990. He was very, very heavily involved in Camps with Meaning. He believed very, very much in the important role that summer camp would play, summer overnight camp would play in Christian education. And so my grandfather was very, very heavily involved in the founding of one of the camps that are parts of Camp with Meaning, Camp Moose Lake, the lodge of which is up at the top. That lodge still exists. It's since been sold to a different organization, a Franco-Manitoban school organization that still uses it for summer overnight camps, but it no longer belongs to the Mennonite community in Manitoba. I grew up around Camp Moose Lake. Right next to the picture of my grandfather and me there is our cabin at Moose Lake. You can see that the picture taken there is actually on the deck of the cabin right next to it. And that cabin was about 5 minutes away from Camp Moose Lake. And so I grew up in that environment. I grew up in that area. So when my grandmother died in 2004, the cabin was passed on to my aunt and uncle. And they've been living there since, or they've been using it in the summer since. And over the last few years, they've sort of engaged in this process of clearing out old material. You know, old Reader's Digests, old devotional materials that my grandparents saved. And one of the things they found was this book. And it's a book published by the YMCA's Association Press in New York City. And the book is called Managing the YMCA Camp. The rather long subtitle is Handbook of Good Practices in the Administration and Operation of the Modern Residential Youth Camp. And it's by a guy named John A. Ledley. This book was published in 1961. It was published 4 years after the establishment of Kent Moose Lake in 1957, and it was published about 75 years after the YMCA in North America started getting into overnight camping. And so this was a really important book within the YMCA and within its sort of camp administration. The book itself is remarkably comprehensive. It's 290 pages long, it has 17 chapters, and it covers everything from the history of the beginnings of YMCA camping in the United States to the day-to-day management of the summer overnight camp. It includes sample forms, so probably some of the forms that you may use now in the camps that you work out are samples, are forms based on the samples published originally in this book. This book is hugely important in the history of YMCA camping, essentially a collection of all the wisdom that had been gathered in the first 75 years of YMCA camping into one easy instructional manual for anybody who wanted to operate a summer camp to use. And so what this book means to me, and this connection to me, is that I like to imagine that when my grandfather, Henry Gertsen, was involved in opening Camp Moose Lake in 1957, this was the manual he used. It was in the cabin. I don't know for a fact that he used this extensively when he was opening up Camp Moose Lake, but for me, this is a very tangible and personal connection between my own history of camping, my own connection with my grandfather, and the YMCA's role as an originator of summer camping, summer overnight camping, especially in North America. Ledley himself, who published this book, John A. Ledley, he published this towards the end of his career. He was with the YMCA for 44 years. During that period, he was heavily involved in things, especially like boys' work, summer camping. And he ended his career around the time that this book was published as the United States Youth and Camping Secretary. So at the YMCA of United States headquarters, he was the Youth and Camping Secretary. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about this book a little bit later. I'm going to sort of go back in time a little bit and do a bit of a chronological discussion of YMCA summer camping. But this book is really interesting and really important. It marks a really interesting moment in the evolution of outdoor education and environmental education in the YMCA. And so this book, I really like to assume that this book was hugely formative, that this book, and it's not a copy of this book, it is this book, was handled by my grandfather and was used by him when he was setting up this new camp system. And one of the things I really like to talk about when I talk about the history of the YMCA, this is a blown-up picture of the book. As you can see, it's well-worn. The only thing that would have made this better is if there would have been like notes written in the margins and little, you know, stickies. Well, I guess not stickies at the time, but little pieces of notepaper. Unfortunately, those do not exist. Part of the reason I think that that didn't happen is because my grandfather actually really loved books. After he retired, he spent some time as a bookbinder, so he bound his own books, and so he really loved books, and so I don't think it would have worked for him to have written in this book. So as a historian, I wish that had happened. As a grandson, I understand why it probably didn't. And so one of the things I really like talking about when I talk about the YMCA, and one of the things I find really fascinating about the YMCA, and one of the reasons I chose to study it, is because the YMCA has been hugely influential in the formation of any number of other voluntary sector, charitable sector organizations. And so when I talk about summer camp, when I talk about overnight camping, I talk about the YMCA because the YMCA really was the originator of this idea of overnight camp. And it was very, very instrumental in creating this whole new sub-discipline or new discipline of outdoor education. But I also like talking about other organizations that the YMCA was heavily involved in. And so I've chosen this one because it was very important. It also lets me put up a big romantic picture of a European 19th century battle that usually brings people into the lecture and makes them interested. The YMCA was hugely involved, in this case, in the founding of the International Committee of the Red Cross. So who here has heard of the International Committee of the Red Cross? Probably everyone. There are probably more people in the world who've heard of the ICRC than have heard of the YMCA, if you can believe it. And so the story goes, the man in the upper left is a guy named Henri Dunant. Henri Dunant was the first secretary of the Geneva YMCA. It was founded in 1852. In 1855, he was in Paris as part of the meeting of the first international committee of the YMCA. He was one of the signatories of the Paris Basis. So he's a very important person in the YMCA. He was heavily involved for the rest of his life. He was always a member of the Geneva YMCA. But he was also a commercial businessman. He traveled frequently around Europe. I don't remember exactly what he sold, but he was a frequent traveler. And this picture is actually a picture of the Battle of Solferino. And so the Battle of Solferino happened in 1859. 300,000 men were involved. It was between the French and the Austrians over what would happen to Italy. Not important that you remember that. Just, this was one of these big 19th century battles. And what happened was Henri Dunant came to the battlefield a couple days after the battle had happened. And there were all sorts of wounded people, dead people lying on the battlefield. They hadn't been taken care of. Armies at this time were not equipped to take care of people who were wounded or injured in battle. And he was horrified by what he saw. And so what he did was he got back to Geneva. He called in some other members of the Geneva YMCA and said, we need to form an organization that will provide medical and humanitarian services during war and during battle. And so was formed the International Committee of the Red Cross. And I tell this story, and the way this connects is that the YMCA in its early history was very, very heavily involved in spawning all sorts of other organizations. In the case of summer camps, the YMCA originated the idea of overnight summer camps, and that spawned and inspired all sorts of other organizations that then became involved and then created their own summer camps. In my case, Camps with Meaning, which was the summer camp system of the Mennonite community in Manitoba. And so I really like talking about that, and I will talk about it some more, in fact, as we go into the history of camping and summer camp within the YMCA. The late 19th century was a really interesting time for the YMCA. You know, when the YMCA was first formed in the 1840s and 1850s, it really focused on religious work. It was about creating safe spaces for young men who lived in the big industrial cities of Europe and North America to come together and engage in Christian fellowship, study the Bible together, talk about God, and strengthen themselves so that they could face the difficulties of this new and emerging industrial society, so that they could face the difficult workplaces and the factories, so that they could be strengthened to avoid the vices that people perceive went along with industrialization, like alcohol, prostitution, gambling, all these things that these young men had to be protected from. And they came together to do this kind of religious work, to create these kinds of religious communities. But what started happening in the 1860s and 1870s, especially in the United States, is that they found they needed ways to bring young men into these organizations. Christian community Bible study wasn't enough. These young men wanted to have a reason, something to do while they were in these groups, while they were part of these associations, that wasn't just this kind of explicitly religious recreation or religious work. And so what started to happen is that in the 1860s and the 1870s, YMCA started to open up gymnasiums. And so you get YMCAs opening up spaces where games could be played, where recreation could be done. And this was really initially about just bringing in people to the YMCA so that they could be exposed to the Christian message that the YMCA held so centrally. But what started to happen is you started to have the sort of involvement of people in the YMCA who came to see that physical education and recreation was a good thing in its own right. And so what they started to do is they started to figure out ways that they could sort of justify that they could explain why these were good things through a Christian lens. And one of the most important people in that evolution was a guy named Luther Gulick. And I'm sure you've seen Luther Gulick's picture down in the sort of heritage area on the first floor or the ground floor. But Luther Gulick was a hugely important figure in the YMCA and really set the direction for the YMCA from the late 19th century. Luther Gulick was a very interesting man. He had grown up the child of missionaries in Hawaii. So he'd done his early education in Hawaii. And then he'd come to the northeastern United States and done his college and university education. And he became involved in the YMCA very early on in his life. So he first joined the YMCA in the 1880s. His first YMCA job was as the director of physical education at the Jackson, Michigan YMCA. I don't know if we have anybody from the Jackson, Michigan YMCA. That would be pretty amazing. But that's where he got his start. From there, he became the assistant physical director for the New York City YMCA, which, of course, at the time was the largest YMCA in the United States. And from there, he became secretary of the International Committee's physical department, and then finally a faculty member at the YMCA's new training school at Springfield, Massachusetts in 1887. And it was at Springfield, Massachusetts that he was to become hugely important, because not only at Springfield did he create the justification, the rationale for this heavy involvement in physical education, he also educated a generation of YMCA leaders. It used to be in the 1880s and into the early 20th century, if you were a YMCA leader, you would likely have gone at some point to Springfield College to do education, to do some kind of leadership work. And so he had a huge impact on the YMCA. The picture here, of course, that's Luther Gulick. This is an early YMCA gymnasium where men are participating in sort of a rhythmic, choreographed gymnastics. And then, of course, at the top is the early symbol of the YMCA, and I'm going to talk about that now. Gulick became really, really heavily concerned not just with the spiritual well-being of young men. He became really, really concerned with their physical well-being. There was a perception that industrial cities were very unhealthy places. They were polluted, they were dirty, and that they were turning these young men who had come from the country, hale and healthy and ready to work, into very weak, sickly, anemic, unhygienic men. And so there was this idea that a really important thing that the Y could do through these already established gymnasia was that they could create the conditions by which young men could become physically as well as spiritually healthy. And so one of Gulick's big innovations was what we have here. It's the fourfold program of the YMCA as embodied by the YMCA triangle. And I'm going to read a little bit specifically because I have some nice quotes from Luther Gulick. He set this out in depth in a paper he wrote and presented in Kansas City as part of the American International or the North American International Committee meetings in 1891. And he really pushed the idea that rather than just focusing on the religious life of the young men, Gulick thought that they had to focus on not just the religious, but also the physical and the emotional lives of these young men. And so what he put forward was this idea of the fourfold program. And basically the fourfold program saw that as it had as its goal that physical, spiritual, and emotional health, the spirit, body, and mind, all combined within the triangle to create a sense of community and unity. According to Gulick, the person of his gospel was that, quote, every age association worker shall set before himself the ideal of the perfect man and work toward it, body, mind, and spirit. And really, this became the sort of defining idea of the early YMCA. It, of course, started in the United States, but Canada was very heavily involved in that they shared the same international governing committee, and this quickly spread to other European YMCAs. And it's important to remember that at this early stage, in the 1880s and 1890s, the YMCA was still very much confined to North America and Europe. It hadn't spread globally in the way it has today. And this emphasis on physical education and recreation really continued to grow in the YMCA exponentially. So the first gymnasia in the United States, YMCA, were founded in 1869 in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco. In 10 years, 50 associations in the United States and Canada had gyms. And by 1900, 455 did. And this really became the dominant factor of the YMCA in North America at this time. And what comes from the physical education, there's another expansion that takes place around the same time in the late 1870s, and that's an increasing focus on work with boys. So initially the YMCA is about young men who gather together, form these associations, work with each other. As the YMCA becomes increasingly professionalized, as there are more and more YMCA leaders increasingly interested in doing mission work with a larger number of people, there's an increasing emphasis on working with ever younger boys. And so the idea is that if we can get them into the YMCA younger, we can prevent them from being exposed to things that will be harmful to their development, and we can bring them into this family, into this organization. And this really comes about as at a time when the world is increasingly seeing children and young people as having value in and of themselves. Before this, for example, there was no such thing as child labor laws, right? So throughout the Industrial Revolution, you would have young children regularly working in factories, working 40, 50-hour weeks, doing work that was dangerous, poorly paid, and really unsuited to children. And really what you see in the late 19th century is a revolution where children are seen as having value in and of themselves. And the YMCA is very much a part of this revolution. It very much sees these children and young people as having value and seeks to bring them in and protect them through an increasing focus on work with ever younger boys within the YMCA. And this expansion of boys' work really led to an increasing involvement in things like overnight camping. One of the other really interesting things about this expansion into boys' work is this spawns a whole new group of organizations and associations that come out of the YMCA. So, for example, by 1900, the International Committee of the YMCA, which is the governing body of the Canadian and American Ys, they hire their first boys' work secretary. He's a guy named Edgar Robinson. He's American.
And his whole goal is to organize and expand the programs that exist to reach out to young boys. And remember, at this time, this is still boys and men. Women generally are not part of the YMCA at this early on, except for as auxiliaries. So they're the wives or the partners or the daughters of YMCA members, and they'll participate, but they're not members of the association at this point. So Edgar Robinson, in 1900, becomes the first association boys' work secretary, and he works diligently to expand the offerings to boys. And he brings exponentially more boys into the YMCA in the early period of his leadership. He's also very, very heavily involved in encouraging other organizations that work with boys to create. And so one of the interesting things is he also, while he's the YMCA Boys Work Secretary, becomes the first managing director of the Boy Scouts of America. So the Boy Scouts are founded in 1907 internationally. The American body is founded in 1910. And he agrees, while still working for the YMCA, to be the director of the Boy Scouts for a short time before they can organize themselves properly and hire their own leadership. And so really what you see with the YMCA, like with their impact on the International Committee of the Red Cross, like with their impact on physical education and sport, the YMCA is very much an originator organization in this field. And this brings me to summer camp. So what you see here in the late 19th century and the early 20th century is the YMCA becoming increasingly involved in physical education, a leader in work with young people. And one of the things that you start seeing is you start seeing an expansion of the programs for these young people. And in the 1800s, or the 1880s, what you start seeing for the first time is the introduction of outdoor education. And so what you start seeing is you start seeing YMCA boys' work camp, boys' work secretaries, especially in the northern United States, start taking their boys out on excursions, so first day hikes, and then eventually overnight excursions, and then eventually 2 or 3 week camping trips. And you really start to see this in the 1880s, and it goes along hand in hand with the expansion of boys' work and the expansion of physical education. These are all part of the same movement and the same moment within the YMCA. And what you see is, at the same time that YMCA centers, YMCA buildings are being built, the YMCA also starts to move its overnight camping and outdoor education into more and more permanent establishments. So the first YMCA camp is founded in 1885. It's founded by a boys' work secretary named Sumner Dudley, who worked at the time for the New York State YMCA. The first year it's established in Lake Orange. It's just some tents. This is actually a group picture of some of the first participants in that YMCA boys' work summer camp. And so that first, you know, it's some tents. It's not an established summer camp. So the first year it happens in Lake Orange, New Jersey. The following year it happens in Lake Waywanda, New Jersey. And finally it's established near Lake Champlain, New York. And this is the oldest YMCA summer camp in the United States, actually in the world. And it is still in operation. It still has campers at Camp Dudley is now what it's called, who go to upstate New York and participate in the same kinds of YMCA summer camp that, of course, you all participated in or have participated in. This is actually just a later picture from Camp Dudley. So, of course, the first years of summer camp, it's very much about being in tents, about being outside, about establishing your own camp. Of course, by the early 1900s, this becomes more and more permanent. The infrastructure becomes established. Regulations and staffing becomes much more regularized. And really what you see from this moment in 1885 is a really, really rapid development of YMCA summer camping. So in 1885, you have the establishment of Camp Dudley. In earlier years, even in the 1880s, you have a lot of rambling tours and camping expeditions. But really, this becomes the moment where they start to establish these camps as physical spaces run by established YMCAs that provide regularized program for an increasing number of young men and boys. And this trend towards summer camp comes out of a number of different forces that are very, very, very powerful in society in this time. Social Darwinism, social hygiene, and character building. So that should say character building rather than building character. But essentially there was this idea that young men, especially in the United States, especially in Canada, especially in Britain, in these industrialized countries, are becoming further and further removed from nature, further and further removed from the outdoors. And why are the outdoors important? Well, the outdoors are important because that's where you become a man. You become a man by chopping wood, by building your own house, by farming your own land, by shooting your own bears, right? So there's this idea that men have to be brought back, boys and men have to be brought back to nature so that they won't become dissolute, so they won't become weak, so they won't become disconnected from nature, which is where manhood is formed. The pictures I have up here, the first one is Teddy Roosevelt, who of course was the American president in the early 1900s. He was a famous supporter of the YMCA. He was a famous supporter of the scouting movement. He actually called YMCAs manhood factories. These were where men were made. And he was hugely involved in outdoor education. He was the founder of the American National Park System. He really believed in this idea that men had to be protected and they had to be strengthened, and the only place that this could happen was in the great outdoors. And so this gives huge impetus to camping, this gives huge impetus to boys' work, and this becomes really very much a mainstream thing. And of course, this is an early picture, probably from the 1940s or 50s, of boys camping at a YMCA camp. Even at that late date, the camp cabin is still a tent. You know, this is very much not about coming to an established camp, you know, being sort of pampered. This is about going out into nature and creating the conditions for your own survival. And that's very much where this idea of character building comes from. And it becomes an idea heavily associated with imperialism and colonialism, the idea of raising these young men to go out into the world, and not just to be missionaries for Christianity, but also to be missionaries for European civilization. And that's where the idea of social Darwinism comes in. And so these are really the places where the men who are losing their manhood in the late Industrial Revolution go to retain or go to create that idea of manhood. And so gender is hugely important in the early idea of YMCA camping. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. But what is interesting, you know, in connecting to sort of the themes I've established, is that the YMCA's leadership in overnight camping spreads quite rapidly to a whole bunch of different places, and is hugely influential in a number of different ways. So the first group up top, of course, is a group of American Boy Scouts. These Boy Scouts are part of the first group that creates the first Boy Scout camp in the early 1900s. I think the year was 1912 or 1913. And so the Boy Scouts, of course, Edgar Robinson was an early leader of scouting while he was a YMCA leader. The Boy Scouts very much internalized this idea around building character. That is why they exist. And they learn how to set up summer camps. They learn how to set up their organization. And they're heavily inspired by the YMCA. The second group on the bottom, these are German members of a movement called the Wandervogel. And essentially, that's the wandering birds is the translation. And this was a hugely important movement in Germany. It spread to Switzerland and Austria. And it was very heavily influential in Central Europe. And essentially, these were young men in these countries, young men in these German countries, going out into nature on hikes, establishing their own campsites, learning how to survive in the wilderness, of course, with a guitar and a message of, in this case, much more nationalistic brotherhood than Christian brotherhood. But this was also a movement that was very, very heavily influenced by the YMCA. As an aside, at this point in the early 1900s, the YMCA in Germany was actually the second largest YMCA after the American YMCA. So the YMCA in Germany was hugely influential. It got pulled into a world in which youth movements were very, very, very prominent. And so it was hugely important in supporting things like the Wandervogel movement and other camping movements that were very influential in Central Europe at the time. This third picture is a man named Taylor Statton. Taylor Statton is interesting because Taylor Statton was the first exclusively Canadian boys' work secretary. He was hired in 1910, and he was very heavily involved in creating these boys' work and camping programs in Canada. In 1921, he actually went his own way. He left the YMCA, and he created an organization called the Taylor Statton Camps Movement. And essentially, the Taylor Statton Camps Movement really provided the foundation for camping in Canada. And he, of course, was YMCA boys' work secretary before going his own way, creating his own camping organization, and really moving to establish this as a professional organization. The interesting thing, too, about Taylor Statton is the Taylor Statton camps were generally considered to be among the very first camps established by private individuals, independent of organizations like the YMCA or various church movements and church organizations. So Taylor Statton is hugely influential in the development of camping, in Canada especially. So there's one interesting point. I hope you've noticed that everybody in every one of these pictures is male. Camping until the 1920s and 1930s was almost entirely considered to be a male activity. It was all men, it was all boys, it generally wasn't women. Yes?
Can you just remind me of the time of that bottom picture?
So this is actually a later Wandervogel picture. It's from the 1930s, but they were active as early as the 1890s in Germany, especially that spread throughout Central Europe. This picture of Taylor Statton is from the 1920s, after he's already left the YMCA. This picture of Boy Scout summer campers is in the early 1910s, so 1911, 1912. But it is important to note this was very gendered. Summer camp was about boys and men. It was about building character, and that implied building masculine character. And so that was a very important part of the early idea of camp. And it was a very, I mean, this is already at this early period, you see the YMCA starts to talk about the concept of outdoor education. But outdoor education is very confrontational. It's about going into nature. It's about confronting nature, exploiting nature, and turning nature to your will. It's not about living in communion with nature. It's about surviving in the harshness of nature. And so it's very much about building this masculine ideal that can go out into the wild, out into the wilderness, and through physical exertion, through group effort, can create civilization, essentially. And so this is very much what outdoor education is. It's not the environmental education that we know, and that I'm going to talk about at the end of this presentation. It's very confrontational, it's very exploitative. And the idea really for people as early as Luther Gulick, but throughout this entire period, was that this was a way that men could be strengthened, that boys and men could progress, could evolve, and could become more masculine. And this was a key part of outdoor education and of overnight camping. And so really, the YMCA is the leading organization that explores this, idea of education in the great outdoors. But there are many other organizations that do. I'm now going to come back to managing the YMCA camp, because for me this book is a hugely important book and is hugely interested in this evolution that I'm talking about. The managing the YMCA camp actually comes out of a meeting that happens in January 1957 that's held by the United States YMCA. And essentially it's part of this conference that seeks to create a national framework for camping. Up until this point, all the different summer camps in the United States are operated independently by individual YMCAs. There's generally no central leadership. There's no central curriculum. They're very much operated independently, depending on, you know, the opinions and ideas of the leaders operating these individual camps. And so the idea, and this is when Ledlie becomes the national director for camping, the national secretary for camping. The idea behind this book is to create an instruction manual, a curriculum, a book that will guide all YMCA camping, that will inform how YMCA camps are operated in North America. And it's really notable that even at this very late date, so this is 1957, that the meeting's held, the book is prepared and published in 1961. Really, when we talk about outdoor education, we still talk about this very sort of exploitative, this very confrontational way of looking at nature. And I'm just going to read a little part here that I thought was really interesting. And so it's in a section called Exploiting the Outdoors, and this is the only section where they talk about outdoor education in this book. In these days of comforts and conveniences, where pressure on a button produces light or even heat, and but little more effort is required to secure the necessities of food, shelter, and clothing, youth are deprived of many of the benefits of the struggle with the environment. Struggles, right? And they really did write like this. I'm not making this up. The pioneer ancestors of a boy lived in close contact with elemental processes which made great demand, but repaid with a quality of life which is often absent from modern urban life. Philip Wiley, in an article in Reader's Digest, Safe and Sane, stated it this way: the life of a child ought to be a process of adventure, experience, exploit. Only thus can he become truly adult, emotionally mature. Only thus can he achieve self-reliance and independence. Children have the right to observe and experience every fact of nature, animal, mineral, and vegetable. They have a right to learn such truth and consequences as their emotional developmental permits in environs where they can dig, pluck, board, build, walk, swim, and chop without let or hindrance. Children have the right to take such natural risks as their teaching in nature gives them the competence to face. So this, even at this late date, in 1957, and then, well, I guess 1961 when this was published, outdoor education is not environmental education. It's about learning how to wrestle with, how to tame, how to exploit nature. And so this is really interesting, and this takes me to a really interesting point, because in some ways, to this point, the YMCA is very much the leader in outdoor education. It's very much the leader in summer camp. It's very much the leader in what this relationship between boys and girls, because at this point, thousands of girls in the United States, North America in general, and Europe are going to camp. They still talk about it as though it's boys. Very much till this point, the YMCA is a leader, and it's at this point that in some ways the YMCA gets overtaken by other events and loses its leading position when it comes to what outdoor and then environmental education looks like. And so This brings me to the year 1962. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard of this book. This is the most important book published on the issue of the environment, or it's one of the first important books. It's generally considered to be the birth of the modern environmental movement. It's published by Rachel Carson, who's an American marine biologist, conservationist, and author. And the book is called Silent Spring. And basically, Silent Spring is the first book published about the environment, that cares for the environment in a way that you and I now would recognize as modern environmentalism. And so this is published 1962, so very late. And this is published sort of ironically a year after managing the YMCA camp. But essentially, the book is about the effects of chemical pesticides on the natural environment. This is generally, by all historians, considered to be the birth of the modern environmental movement. And so what you start seeing after the publication of this book, and rarely are books that are published this important, but what you start seeing after the publication of this book is a growing understanding of the need of humans, essentially of humanity, to protect the natural environment. So there's this real change, this real sea change at this moment, where instead of seeing the natural environment and the great outdoors as something to be exploited and survive, it becomes something to be protected and understood and lived with. And so this is hugely important. And what this really leads to in the 1960s is the birth of the modern environmental movement. And so some of the highlights, for example, are the founding of the first environmental NGO, the Environmental Defense Fund in the United States in 1967. And it's explicitly inspired by Silent Spring, and it explicitly exists to protect the environment in a way that you and I would now be familiar with. This leads to the proclamation of the first Earth Day in 1970. And not only are these ideas around protecting the environment scientific and secular, but there's also a growing willingness within the Christian community to wrestle with what a Christian outlook and what a Christian idea around environmental stewardship looks like. And one of the sort of trends that comes out of that is something called dominion theology. And that basically is an understanding that God has given humanity dominion over the earth. And that implies that we have a responsibility not just to use and exploit the earth, but also to protect and care for the earth. And that's part of our duty as Christians. And so really in the 1960s, you have this huge change in the understanding of the relationship between humanity and the natural world. And what you then start to see through the 1970s is you start to see an increasing understanding, an increasing attempt to define what environmental education looks like. So the first big meeting that you have where they start talking about where they coin the term environmental education is in 1971, and it's the founding of the North American Association for Environmental Education. And this is a group of scholars and teachers and activists who come together and start to define what environmental education means. And things really proceed rapidly after that. In 1972, at a United Nations meeting in Stockholm, there's a declaration basically on the responsibility of humanity to protect the human environment. So we're still having these meetings now. We still don't always agree. But beginning in 1972, there was this real concerted attempt on the part of the United Nations to establish what the relationship between humanity and the environment should look like. That was followed in 1975 by a Belgrade meeting, Belgrade in Yugoslavia, and the Charter on Environmental Education, where the United Nations started to set out principles for what environmental education looked like. What really I found interesting, this to me was the part that I knew the least about. This was the part where I learned and I explored this topic the most personally when I was doing the research, is that since then, since the 1970s, we've really struggled as a planet, as a species, over what environmental education looks like. So, for example, in the 1970s, there was the creation of numerous outdoor education, environmental education organizations. A good one to note is Outward Bound, that sought to promote travel, camping, engagement with nature among young people in order not to exploit nature necessarily, but much more to engage with it in a much more positive and protective way. But this has really gone on and off. There have been times like the 70s where this was very, very de rigueur, where this was really heavily promoted. In the 1980s, however, there was very little evolution. There was very little movement in environmental education. People were generally becoming aware of the impact of human activity on the environment, but there was little interest in developing a concerted response, especially through education. And so one of the things that I've really noticed, you know, in doing this research, and I'm really happy if we have this discussion and if people sort of provide me with more information, is that one of the things that seems to me that's happening within the YMCA movement, the global YMCA movement, is that a lot of this environmental education work
the development of curricula, the development of standards, the development of programs is generally done by individual YMCA. So it's really interesting to me, because what happens in 1961, of course, is that there's this attempt to create this universal YMCA curriculum, this universal YMCA idea of what what outdoor education, at least in this case, looks like, of what summer camp, of what overnight camp looks like, and that because of the really sort of disrupting influence of the creation of the environmental movement in the 1960s and 70s, that right when there was that attempt to sort of standardize and universalize, there was something that immediately came in and undercut it, and instead sort of took the power away from those kinds of central organizations to define what outdoor education and then environmental education meant, and that it became very much a part of individual YMCAs and part of their work individually on summer camp. That's all I have. I really want to thank you. I do hope that I've connected my story of summer camp with a larger story of summer camp and also tried to tie it to issues of environmental education and environmental sustainability. We still have 20 minutes. I'm more than happy to answer anybody's questions or comments or to have a further discussion about this. So please feel free to raise your hand and contribute. Yeah?
So the YMCA created the first summer camp?
The YMCA, yeah, effectively. The YMCA was the organization that really originated the idea of summer camp as we know it. So the first sort of summer camp that looks like a summer camp as we know it was Camp Dudley that was founded in upstate New York, or well, New Jersey first, but then upstate New York. So yeah, that's one of the interesting things about the YMCA. There are a lot of different ways that the YMCA, partly because it's such an old organization, but because it's such a broad organization in its interests, was so heavily involved in founding all sorts of different movements and different ideas.
I guess kind of a question for the room, and then also just like a statement that I'm like, oh, this is like so much more applicable to my work than I thought. So I work at YMCA Camp Campbell, which is the camping branch of the Silicon Valley Association in California. And like we have a residential summer camping program. We have a date that the kids come stay, reside there during like 4 weeks, 2 weeks, 1 week, whatever. And we have day camping, so you come on the day and you leave. And then we have science camp or outdoor ed, depending on which person you talk to at our camp. There's a very heated discussion about what we call it.
Or environmental education, you could throw that in there.
Yes, exactly. So it's like the terms are like so, like people are really passionate about what we're going to call it. And then all those curriculums are slightly different. And so it's interesting to see that like all of this is related in a way. And then also we've talked about how we wish there was more connection and resources between other Y camps or even just other camps. So when I saw that book, what? Oh my gosh, it's crazy. Like, so I don't know, has anyone else had that experience? Does anyone else feel like they were looking for more connection between camping? Or I don't know. Just so confused.
Anybody else wanna get in on that? I mean, I have something to say, but
I find that people from summer camp, it's like, you understand it if you've been, like, camp culture is something that's very, like, you need to experience to understand it, and it would be cool if there was more connection between all the camps, and, like, even if there was, like a camp conference, like, where we went out to one of the big YMCA camps in the country and, like, explored all the different options, kind of like this kind of camp setting.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, too. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about the early YMCA is a lot of these developments that happen in the early YMCA, they really, you know, until you start getting this increasingly professionalized, you know, sort of secretaryship, you know, because, of course, that's what they call YMCA, leaders with secretary in the past. A lot of these ideas, a lot of these sort of initiatives kind of came organically from within the YMCA, right? So the first YMCA gymnasia that are open, they're not open because there's some, like, large discussion about how we need to do this to bring in members is because certain YMCA started doing it. And, you know, I was just doing a sort of a survey this afternoon of YMCA, you know, sort of environmental education, and there are a lot of YMCAs that already have curricula that they seem to have developed, but I don't know how broadly that's spread, right? So, for example, there are a number of YMCAs in the United Kingdom that have explicitly environmental education rather than outdoor education. I noticed that there were a few in Michigan that appeared to have environmental rather than outdoor education, and environmental based on, you know, ideas of environmental sustainability rather than, you know, this sort of negotiation between nature and humanity, right? I mean, it's really interesting, too, that you say that. Like, I remember my existence growing up at you know, camps with meaning, you know, first as a camper and then as a counselor and community instructor. And for us, I mean, this was, when was this? Like, early to late 90s, you know, there was no discussion of environmental education in the way that, you know, we should be talking about. You know, if there was like the nature, that's what it was called at the time, right? Nature. It wasn't called outdoor education even. You know, in nature, it would be about learning what poison ivy looks like and learning how to make a fire with sticks, which is, you know, but that's very much out, you know, outdoor education, sort of almost survival skills as seen in this kind of building character era. And it was really interesting to see how powerful this still is, even 50-ish years after the publication of Silent Spring and the real attempt to transition from an idea of outdoor education to an idea of environmental education.
Right.
Your last comment about sort of these shifting tensions pull a thread for me, and another sort of changing dynamic they have is the use of indigenous North American cultures in camping culture, and how they are communicated as living in harmony
within
nature.
Yeah.
And so there's this sort of exploitative piece of that identity, that narrative that happens, and yet they never sort of squared that circle, it seemed, or that was diminishing right at the time maybe they could have used.
Yeah, they're moving to environmental.
Yeah.
I mean, so everybody, by the way, this is Ryan Bean. He's the archivist for the American YMCA, Cubs Family YMCA Archives. Just so everyone knows, he has a book coming out in the relative near future about the Indian Guides program. So essentially the Indian Guides program, and this was part of YMCA camping. And it's which he makes a really good point. One of the really interesting things about this early period of campus character building is that summer camps were often hugely influenced by perceived ideas of indigenous culture, right? So there was this idea of the noble savage, right? And these indigenous people were noble, they were they had character, they were strong, because they lived in nature, because they knew how to survive. I mean, it's really horribly contradictory, because this was, of course, happening at the same time that indigenous people were being pushed onto reserves or being forced to be educated in a Western way through residential schools. And so it's this weird sort of conflicted relationship. But it is interesting because, you know, it was almost like in a time, they would sort of pick and choose which parts of indigenous culture would fit within this program of camping, right? So, you know, hunting and trapping, but maybe not respect for nature, but maybe, you know. But I agree with you, it's hugely conflicted and hugely problematic over what was used and what wasn't, right? Yeah. Yeah, shoot.
I have something to say for a connection between YMCA camps. It's like in Switzerland, we have quite a different system of camps. Mm-hmm. It works a little bit different, but for example, our local organization has some partnerships. One partnership with Belarus, and we always exchange. Like some summer we go there and visit their camps, then another summer they come and visit our camps. So if you're interested in visiting a Swiss camp, well, no problem. Just grab one of us and exchange numbers or emails, and then you can come, because we have like some local organizations have like three camps a year. Others have one, and
well,
it's never a problem.
It's interesting, too, because, I mean, this connects with this a little bit, too, because one of the things that's really interesting in the history of the YMCA is often what happens in the YMCA is ideas are shared, right? So you'll have one YMCA that's doing something, that initiates something, that starts some program, and very quickly that can become a part of the global YMCA movement because it's shared between different YMCAs. So, for example, my own work is on YMCA military work, so YMCA work with soldiers. And this was very, very common in the late 19th, early 20th century. And the reason it spread throughout the YMCA is because you have certain YMCA workers who come from Canada or the United States, for example, they'd go to Britain, and they would initiate these same kind of programs. And so that's one of the interesting things about the YMCA movement, is that there are always these opportunities for creating these new programs and for sharing this knowledge, because there is such an emphasis on the connections between YMCA members throughout the world. Any more questions? Is there any part? Oh, yeah.
I've got one that's necessarily related to the campus. I'm interested that you, your specific interest is in YMCA's kind of service and war.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the team has been doing heritage stuff downstairs, and when we were doing research, found lots that was to do with YMCA's service to Western allies.
Mm-hmm.
And noticed that you were saying that YMCA was specifically active in Germany and Central Europe during the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
Were YMCA active in service of war to in other areas, not just the Western Allies?
One of the, in my research, one of the really interesting things I found is that the YMCA could be very susceptible to international conflict. So, for example, I do a lot of work around the First World War, and what happened in the YMCA during the First World War was that there really was a break in the YMCA. So, for example, Canadian, American, British, Western European YMCAs would work with Allied soldiers, and during the First World War, the German YMCA was effectively excluded from the international association. And so Ys tend to be very, very susceptible, or in the past, when they did military work, tended to be very susceptible to what would happen during wartime. So, for example, the Canadian and the American YMCA split apart in the early 1900s, and a huge reason that they split apart in the early 1900s was because of two shockingly obscure wars that I'm sure nobody in this room has even heard of, the Spanish-American War and the Boer War. And basically, the Spanish-American War was a war that the Americans fought with Spain to take over the Philippines and sort of power in the Caribbean. The Boer War was a war fought between the British and the Canadians and Australians and other parts of the British Empire against the South African Boers, you know, over who would control South Africa. And what was really interesting in this moment was that military work in North America was done by the International Committee, and the International Committee was the body of the Canadian and the American YMCAs. And the Boer War was hugely unpopular in the United States. The Spanish-American War was hugely unpopular in Canada. And so part of the reason that the Canadian and American YMCAs broke apart and created their own national federations was because of differences of opinion over how they would do military work in those two conflicts. And so the YMCA can be, you know, because it's so global, because it's so broad, global conflict and those kinds of issues can become hugely problematic for the YMCA, or in the past they have. I think the YMCA has generally moved beyond that, but in the past that was a big issue for the YMCA. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thanks very much, everyone. I appreciate you coming to this session right at the end of the conference. I'm going to be here for the next 10 or 15 minutes or however long, so if anybody has any individual questions, please come up and chat with me. I'm happy to talk. And also, I can provide anybody with my information if they have want further information about this or about anything else. It's also my understanding that this is going to be published as a podcast on the site for YMCA 175, so you know, feel free to go and listen again if you're so inclined. And if you need to, I'm also happy to share my slides and my paper with everyone. So thank you very much.